Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. In this episode, I speak with former podcaster and grad student Amogh Sahu. Amogh used to run the Symptomatic Redness podcast with previous guest C. Derek Varn. He currently studies philosophy and critical theory at the University of Columbia. Right now, you're listening to 22 Ghosts 3, but in a moment, you'll hear our discussion around Lukács, class consciousness, totality, and whether or not there is a definitive Marxian method. Hello, welcome. Today, I have with me Amogh Sahu, who is a PhD student working on philosophy and critical theory at Columbia, and also used to be co-host of the now-defunct podcast,
Symptomatic Redness.
Yeah, I think I started thinking Sectarian Review. I'm like, no, that's like that other one, the evangelical one. Thank you for joining. And so I reached out in part because you had a discussion with fellow podcaster and guest C. Derek Varn that went a little bit into kind of the roots of Western Marxism and Lukács and, you know, what is totality, what is class consciousness, that kind of thing. And given that we read the first pieces by Lukács in this series, and there's more books by him that we're going to read in the future, it being the first time I've read Lukács, I was struck by, like, wow, this guy, there's something about his writing that does have this kind of hypnotic quality of, like, you're getting into it and you're like, wow, this guy's like, really, even when he's writing about some like aesthetic thing about like, does German expressionism matter, like he really gets that kind of grandiose feeling of like, this is theory, this is what theory is about. You also kind of get that, I got that inkling of like that suspicion of like, but like, what is this really like doing? So I thought it might be interesting to have a discussion kind of like, why does Lukács have this place of like, he's the central question mark for a lot of people about like Western Marxism. Is it its own tradition? Does it have something substantial to add to this idea of what Marxism is and like is about? So that's kind of where I was hoping we could go with this. And I know you mentioned, you kind of go into a little bit on the other discussion, and you mentioned it a little bit before we started recording, but do you want to go a little bit into how you encountered Lukács and why you found him to also be kind of a cipher, as you said?
Yeah. So I think for me, as you say, I come from this, like, I guess what I describe as a left book background, mm-hmm. although it's like not very intelligible to people, I guess. I mean, actually, probably is quite intelligible to people who listen to this. I take it, like, for me, the way I got into Marxism very much through my co-host on that podcast, you mentioned C. Derek Varn, we were very interested in this kind of critical stance to this like Marxist revival we mm-hmm. saw like taking shape around us post-financial crisis. I don't have a Marxist background. I have, or at least I didn't at the time have a Marxist background. Now I do, 6 years on. Varn has that effect on you, I think. I think at the time I had a much more kind of like MMT historical, mm-hmm. kind of radical liberal background, much sort of skeptical of Marxism, or just, I mean, questioning and like, confused about it largely. Mm-hmm. And so both of us really interested in trying to get clear on like these like methodological, like what I would call like methodological foundations, right? We were puzzled about these like unproductive debates that we saw happening in these Marxist circles. We weren't sure exactly how the holy Marxist texts were like supposed to resolve all these like hot button political debates or even like theoretical debates in economics. So questions about why does the tendency of the rate of profit to fall matter? What is its political significance? Or who counts as a genuine member of the working class? And mm-hmm. also, what is a genuine member of the working class? Or, for example, what's the relationship between a Marxian theory of crisis, a sort of like long-run theory of crisis of the social form, and like short and medium term techniques of like Keynesian management? Mm-hmm. Because it's so all of these questions we were kind of felt very of the moment, and we kind of tried to figure out what is the genuine bona fide Marxist answer to these questions. Because in the wind was also this idea that like Marxism is different to other kinds of socialist thinking, mm-hmm. right? Because it's uniquely scientific, and also it has this kind of worldview character. Recently, I mean, I wasn't introduced to this at the time. Recently, I figured out like worldview Marxism is a thing. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily mean to refer to, I think I mean worldview in just like the more generic sense of like, mm-hmm. wow, if you're a Marxist, you're supposed to have views about like the nature of culture and art. Mm-hmm. And also, these are supposed to connect somehow to your views about like, you know, trade union consciousness and like the steel sector in Pennsylvania. Right. That's all supposed to hang together. So there are these things in the background, right, about like, okay, not only are these questions hard to resolve, we're also part of a theoretical tradition that's supposed to have some kind of like grand account of like how these debates are to be resolved and how they're supposed to fit together. Mm-hmm. And I think the experience, as I think I discussed on that podcast, is just like one of failure, that like mm-hmm. we weren't able to find a foundation or a basis, not because, quote, Marxism is false or something like that. It was more just that there was too much going on to be mm-hmm. able to, like, you know, because these kinds of demands for bases are almost always like demands to like find some set of claims or some set of premises that are going to satisfy everyone in these debates. It's like, mm-hmm. it's partly also like this political exercise. It's not a completely kind of intellectual exercise.
Yeah.
And I think we didn't, I think it failed partly just on that kind of political basis. So given all that, which I can go into, in my academic life, I naturally found Lukács to be a person who really kind of thought through these questions in his own age, right? So one thing me and Derek were especially interested in was this idea that what we were doing was an extremely common occurrence in the history of Marxism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That this kind of search for a method has been part of 20th century Marxism going all the way back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we were really interested in kind of doing the history of the tradition and so on and so forth. That turns out to be a heroic intellectual task that, like, I mean, Derek has been doing for years and years and years in podcast form, but in book form turns out to be even harder. I kind of gave up more out of exhaustion, I think, than anything mm-hmm. else. I'm like, the kind of like contemporary politics facing kind of way of trying to do that. Right? We were really kind of concerned of like, there is debates going on now. There is this like grand history and we're going to like put them together in this like very direct way. I think that's the kind of project I think I got slightly exhausted by. For me, I kind of retreated into like, I was like, this is too big. These concerns are like too big a topic to be like the focus of a single project. Like,
right.
you know, it is a little bit like saying, what are you doing with your life? I'm trying to solve Marxism, right? And it's mm-hmm. like, that can be a high level description of what you're doing, but it can't be like what you tell yourself when you're sitting down to write something. Because like, no one, it turns out, is like able to just like unfold abstract instruction and like unfold the whole completed book right. from that, you know. And it's also like a lot of the people we're engaging with were like, you probably know a lot of them or have listened to a lot of them as like weird internet people with weird niches who are not like necessarily interested in like a long form, good faith academic debate.
Right.
Like it's people with YouTube channels and people like Paul Hochschild, or there are, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so extremely difficult task, extremely unproductive audience. So I was just like, I think I just need to like pick somebody. And this was also academic pressures. It's just like, mm-hmm. why don't you, you know, like I brought all of these left book concerns into this like very specific academic context of like doing a PhD. And like my supervisor, Axel Honneth, is like very, you know, he's like not a neutral participant. Right. But nonetheless, like he obviously is like not from this left book world. Like he doesn't know who C. Derek Van is. Like,
right.
You know, I mean, also he's like, for partly good reasons, not kept up with all of the like like bits of Marxist marginalia that like very popular. Like he doesn't have very developed views on Bodega or Gilles Dervais or Jacques Camus, all these people. Right. So given all of that, like these kinds of my kind of historical trajectory and my, it was like, it's like, why don't you just like pick somebody who like embodies all of these problems in embryo? And like, I was just, I think a couple of years ago, I've shifted slightly. I was just like, okay, I'm just going to write something about Lukács. And it's like not going to immediately speak to like, you know, Andrew Kleiman and the cancel culture and like all the things that are going on right now. But hopefully like step one, History and Class Consciousness seems like an important book. Specifically, the reification essay seems like an important essay. So I'm going to take all of this like mush that I have going on from like, I don't know, 5 years of being some kind of mute participant in like left book conversations and just like try to get something that speaks to those concerns. Anyway, so that was a bit long-winded, but this is like the full picture of how, why Lukács was important. He really was, the worry was somewhat arbitrary. In terms of like it didn't need to be him, but for contingent reasons, like because you know my intellectual background given my supervisor in my department is kind of like the work that I've explicitly done since I started doing my PhD has been very much on critical theory or Hegel and so on and so forth. And Lukács felt like the person who really kind of was some kind of like convergence point, like really introduced the idea of Marxism as a science, Marxism philosophy, and kind of was like, we felt, I felt like a useful cipher for these broader kind of more contemporary questions I was interested in.
Anyone who tries to stick with answering questions, you do often get stuck in this like, okay, I've got to just like talk about another person or another book or a specific event or something if I'm going to and have any concrete practice involved with like, that kind of thinking through the abstract problems holistically. I mean,
you've been in some of these conversations, like some of these like internet debates from an academic perspective are crazy. Like people cite all kinds of random stuff that like they couldn't possibly have read or I could possibly have read. Like people like have all kinds of personal reasons for being Marxist, which they've put into these debates. And also this is not even to talk about like the way in which like particular historical like Kronstadt, et cetera, become like focuses for these, like, you know. So anyway, it's if you orienting your academic practice around like the left podcast world and resolving problems in the left podcast world is like not the most productive.
But that's what
I'm from. I'm like still trying to do that. Like I'm still really, you know, I'm in these academic contexts, but like I was shaped by, like, for want of a better word, the milieu which I assume like you're also speaking to or some part of, which is like that. So that's like I can run as far as I can from that, but eventually I'm gonna be talking to your audience in some way.
And I think in a way though, what's kind of funny is that you can kind of imagine how much the situation with Lukács and all these other kind of 20th century intellectuals, it definitely appears much more robust in aspects and you know, rigorous. But you have to wonder sometimes how much these people themselves are kind of like, I'm surrounded by like all this stuff going on and all these people arguing about like kind of weird petty things and stuff. And I'm just going to write a book. I'm just going to write a good essay that just cuts through it all and like tries to really like, sometimes I have to wonder if that's kind of like a more universal instinct.
That's right. I guess I didn't think of this way, but like, you know, I mean, it's very self-aggrandizing to think like, in a way, but like, yeah, you're right that, you know, Lukács could narrativize history, the writing of History and Class Consciousness in this way. I mean, it's a little bit more serious in the sense of like, okay, by 1919, he's been like part of like the Hungarian.
Exactly.
And like, you know, and he's kind of moved to Vienna and he's like thinking through, moved, exactly.
Yeah.
Quote unquote moved to Vienna. And like, he's thinking through these broader questions. And so he's like coming up with History and Class Consciousness in very much this attempt to like reconcile his like aesthetic commitments, his, you know, his theater stuff, his, you know, debts to Max Weber and neo-Kantianism, and like putting all that together into this one piece. I'm not sure exactly what like practical effect Lukács intended it to have beyond mm-hmm. like the more generic, like, oh, it's supposed to promote revolution, which is like,
yeah.
Yes. But I think he does think like it's supposed to promote revolution and it's supposed to have this like reconciling effect. But in some ways, Lukács' dilemma is like similar to mine in the sense of the reception of history and class consciousness was really bad.
Yeah.
He got denounced as some kind of ultra leftist, which I think is a slightly like unfair reading of the book. And he basically like recants is not the right word, but like tries to, I think, he does explicitly recant, but like a lot of the themes in history class consciousness do just kind of recur. Like, it does not have the effect on like broader European intellectual culture that like he takes it to have, except, mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose Lukács does inaugurate this. People do start thinking in this more integrated way that like, you know, particularly think of things like New Left Review, like four decades mm-hmm. later. There is this, and the Frankfurt School, there is this like. Mm-hmm.
There's an academic current that keeps going with it.
That's right. And it's quite loose. Like, you know, I think it's more that it is now from Lukács, it does become a more accepted thing that if you're a Marxist intellectual in the full-blown sense of the word, it is now like a thing you can conceive of as like, I have to have views about these whole range mm-hmm. of topics and have to integrate them. The thing about these, like, there are, of course, Marxist intellectuals before Lukács, right? Like people who have this mm-hmm. wide breadth of learning and like have this, you know. But with Lukács, it's more like it becomes part of the air that like it's an obligation of some kind, mm-hmm. right? To have this, have, you know, the word theory with a capital T, as mm-hmm. we now understand it, like that is, I think, the Marxist version of that is really like Lukács pioneered that, really. Mm-hmm. There were people who had theories.
Yeah.
But the idea of theory with a capital T mm-hmm. in the Marxist tradition as like, yeah, as I say, this integrated thing, that is really like Lukács' construction. But as you say, this is much more of an academic pursuit and it doesn't influence politics in quite the way Lukács hopes.
Which it's kind of funny because it's like one of those other things where you can see the almost more, I guess, you know, quote unquote, like environmental impact is like, you know, Lukács is someone who sees actual revolutionary activity happening in his time. Like he is an intellectual who sees that and he's participating in party politics and stuff. And it's the fact that like around the same time, the other book that is like proposing stuff that's very similar by someone who also is involved in like actual concrete politics and revolutionary stuff is of course, Karl Korsch, who has Marxism and philosophy and also and writes
honor of getting denounced along with Lukács.
Yeah. And he kind of, you know, it's kind of funny in his, you know, he has his, what does he call it? His anti-critique, his like defense basically of Marxism and philosophy, where he kind of says stuff about, he's like, of course, the other trend that was very similar at the time was George Lukács. And he's like, in hindsight, now I realize we actually have big differences because what he's doing is very different than what I'm doing now. But it's easy to forget, too, that like both of these people were like, you know, Lukács was a cultural commissar and not just in the pejorative sense that Adorno means it. And like Karl Korsch is like an actual representative to like the international and like is in like local German state politics and stuff right. and is doing, right. You know, council. Like he has books on like how to do council economic lessons for union members and stuff. The one thing that is more alien to us is that these were people that are trying to produce rigorous theory because of their experiences in these actual political moments, as opposed to kind of like having theory after the fact to like re-kickstart political moments. Like they think that they're in the heat of the moment and writing this.
Right.
And in fact, that's kind of one of Lukács' own self-criticisms as he says, oh, I was super subjectivist because I was in the midst of a revolutionary situation where it felt like this is what was going to happen. Like right. it was the class consciousness was going to break through what seemed like this, you know, reified society.
Yeah.
And of course, and then he says like, now I can't justify that per se in the same way that I was. But another element with Lukács that's interesting too is that you see with him and with Korsh as well, but Korsh doesn't have as much of the connection to kind of trying to tie Marxism to the trend of like sociology becoming a discipline. Because mm-hmm. of course, Lukács is influenced by Max Weber and also George Sibyl. Mm-hmm. And then what Korsh does alongside more thoroughly is this idea that like you can't, it's not just that you can like read Hegel and be like, oh, there's dialectics and then Marx is doing this thing. It's like Marx is responding to like an actual full-blown tradition of bourgeois philosophy that is in German idealism as a whole.
Right.
That is like much more like that has to be taken as like a whole tradition yeah. related to bourgeois society's development and yeah. like the neo-Kantian tradition and stuff like that.
If I could say something on that, I think it's sort of like, it's in some sense very difficult to even convince people that there is this methodological crisis, or it's like very mm-hmm. difficult. Like there is this big tendency to say something like, well, it's immediately obvious what, quote, the useful bits of Marxism are. Mm-hmm. And so people, the motivations for projects like Korsh's and Lukács's like are very difficult to understand if you have this kind of mindset that it's like you're kind of tilting at windmills, right? The thought is like, look, you mean there are different ways you could have this kind of thought. You could think from this like social scientific perspective that like, look, we need to take Marx's works, boil them down into sociological claims, political claims in political science, claims in economics, right? And like test them out and then et cetera, you know, that kind of thing, right? Or you could have this kind of view where you could say, look, we know what Marxism is. Marxism is whatever is needed in order to help the proletariat achieve their aims, right? This is just, you know, I'm not saying these are the only two ways of doing this. It's just like, the tendency here is to say, look, there is this pre-existing method, right? Well, you have this pre-existing idea of like, you know, this Marxist approach to the world, pre-existing idea of theory, right? Either this like mm-hmm. concrete sociological thing, concrete kind of empirical thing, or there is this kind of voluntarist political thing, right? And the thought mm-hmm. is, those things already tell us what good theory is, and then we approach Marxism, and then we kind of like, you know, we say, for example, like, these are two different ways of being like anti-theory. Right? One is this like positivist sociological thing. The other is this like strugglist, right? And so if you're an empiricist kind of person, you'll just say, oh, come on, there's no methodological crisis. It's just that, you know, we haven't done mm-hmm. the hard yards of like doing the political economy, right? Mm-hmm. There is the value critique people who will say this kind of thing, whether that means something slightly different. I think I'm more thinking here of just like, even now these would be like analytical Marxists, but at the time these would be like people like Bernstein, like reformists. Right? Mm-hmm. So, look, we need to subject Marx's claims about society to empirical test, right? Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there will be people, and I think it is possible to see Luxembourg like this. I think Lukács ultimately doesn't see her like this, as like, oh, who cares about the empirical stuff? Let's mm-hmm. just, you know, like when you're on the streets, you're not
doing,
you know, and both of these mindsets are like profoundly skeptical of this like methodological crisis approach. Like the idea that you need to retreat either from data collection or from practical struggle to some kind of armchair position, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're kind of being like, where does Marxism begin? What is the first proposition? Mm-hmm. What is the logical order? Right. So something has to be said even to justify, right, this kind mm-hmm. of this kind of like retreat to theory or something like that. Right. So does that make sense? I mean, I think
it's
I really think there is a job to be done in like mm-hmm. Marxist circles to even get people interested in like a Korsh-like project or a Lukács-like project, because there are these like inbuilt gag reflexes towards mm-hmm. even the proposition that, you know, it's like, no, we don't need to do all this because all of that will just lead us away from either the real world of data collection and social science or the real world of struggle, mm-hmm. right? And people are vindicated. This kind of mindset is very vindicated by the fact that, like, the Lukács's reification essay neither seems to produce testable predictions in an obvious way.
Yeah.
Or seems to be obviously theorizing some very specific conjuncture.
Right? Yeah.
And so the thought is, well, yeah, I mean, what do you expect when you get into this like bad mindset of abstracting away from the real, the real, either, you know. Well, Lukács himself is trying to say, look, both of these positions, anti-theoretical positions, are dead ends because neither of them, you know, represent, like, neither of them have a particularly clear understanding of what the goal of revolution ought to be.
Right? Yeah.
On this kind of positivist position, which, like, different people can occupy at different times, right? There's really no, like, the social theory is divorced from the activity of the proletariat, right? You kind of, like, engage in this theoretical activity and you kind of try to think about society as an object, as a mere object. And then the thought is, well, there's this other enterprise after theorizing, which is politics, where you, you know, which is like, I mean, this playing with all kinds of neo-Kantian distinctions,
right,
fact and value and what it is and so on. And politics, how is it done? Well, you figure out what people want and, you know, you figure out, quote, the real needs or something like that, right? And that's, like, by definition, not a theoretical exercise, right? Because we have this theory is this, like, discovery, like, kind of detached discovery of laws in like, the positivist scientific sense, right?
Yeah.
Similarly, on the flip side, you have this kind of, like, voluntary spontaneous position, which is, like, who cares about this law stuff? Let's, like, embed ourselves in this, in you know, let's embed ourselves in a struggle and, like, develop theory, quote unquote, in a way responsive to the struggle. Right. So this people will cite this kind of spontaneous tendency will cite, like, you know, theories and intellectual expression of the real movement and all these kinds of, like, Marxist slogans. Right. So, I was about to say Horkheimer. Lukács is interested in like, dialectically transcending, surprise, surprise, these two positions, right? He wants to say, by the way, it's, I mean, to flag Lukács's problem, it's not immediately obvious what the issue is with either position. I've just, so far, I've just, like, described them.
Yeah.
Right? But with Lukács, there's some idea that, like, theory and practice are not integrated, right? That's, like, in both cases, that's the same problem, right? In the one case, there isn't a certain kind of rational basis for, like, which position you take in the struggle. You know, you're just kind of starting from some given, and, you know, this is a spontaneous problem, you're starting from some given, like, which struggle you happen to find yourself in or which struggle you happen to like, you know, and the thought is supposed to be, no, you have to be, you know, you're right. Theory is the intellectual expression of the real movement. But what counts as the real movement, it's something that's determined by, like, quote, the correct social theory. Right? But you then go back to this kind of empiricist position where it's like, well, here is the correct social theory. That's supposed to be problematic because it doesn't show you the way in which, like, you know, theory is supposed to be, and this is, like, you know, Lukács's Hegelian kind of baggage, like, theory is supposed to be a liberating force itself, right? So any conception, it's not that theory is supposed to aid instrumentally or afterwards some, like, separate political revolution. It's that the goal of correctly understanding the world is supposed to be revealed as one and the same as the goal of liberating yourself.
Right? Yeah.
Truth and freedom come together. This is really, really important to Lukács. And so the problem with this kind of positivist position, right, is that on that position, it's not the case that truth and freedom come together, right? We're defining truth purely in terms of, like, you know, capturing correctly what's going on in a world conceived of as separate from our political activity, right? And the spontaneous position just does the reverse, right? It gives you freedom in a sense without truth. Like, you know, there is this conception of activity but it's not connected intrinsically to the correct understanding of the world, right? Now, I think what's really important about this Lukács's criticism is that he is kind of equivocating between like a weaker and stronger claim here, right? So the weaker claim is, look, you need to understand the world correctly in order to change it, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, in order to figure out what the right kind of change is, you need to have this like correct theory of like what levers to pull in order to change the world, right? So practice needs theory in that very minimal sense, right? Similarly, you might think, well, look, we don't just want to correctly understand the world. We want, you know, that's like an unsatisfying conception of like intellectual activity, right? We want to achieve these like practical aims as well. And so a conception of intellectual life, which is like purely independent of practice, is unsatisfying, right? Okay, all this is fine, right? But it doesn't get you dialectics. All it gets you is some like weaker thing about like, well, you know, if you're a social scientist, you should think more about like what politics you do, right? Yeah. If you're like someone engaged in political activity, you should think a lot about strategy, right?
It's just like a basic like call to reflexivity.
Absolutely. But that call to reflexivity could be implemented by, the way I've articulated it, pretty much anyone of any political stripe could like take what I say very seriously, right? You could be a conservative and think, oh, I need to think hard about having a theory of the social world, etc. Mm-hmm. Right? The point is, Lukács defines reflexivity in this incredibly specific way, that theory and practice have to be integrated in a way so as to promote, like create like a rational society through revolution. Mm-hmm. Now, those concepts call immediately for definition, right? What's rationality supposed to be? Revolution, we know a little bit more, like Lukács is taking on a kind of idea of like the irrational social form of social totality, capitalism. So revolution is just like the force that gets us beyond that.
Yeah.
We know that much, right? But Lukács also has this positive idea of like this self-conscious, free, rational society where like, you know, all of these different contradictions in bourgeois culture and philosophy and so on are resolved, right? Mm-hmm. And the point is I don't want to say smuggled in because he's explicit about this, but like in my presentation, in my initial presentation of the criticism, that was that standard of like achievement of Hegelian rationality was being smuggled in. Because note the kind of the move is to say, the positivist, you start from this like weak claim that like the positivist theory is like not reflexive enough, right? Mm-hmm. But you kind of add into this kind of criticism that if it were to be properly reflexive, it would basically be like a Hegelian dialectical theory.
I was just reading some summaries of like stuff where I think it was just on the like standard, you know, Stanford Encyclopedia like of philosophy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they have a little thing just saying like how it's funny because Lukács is thought as like the Hegelian Marxist, you know, like, and they were saying like in the original version of history and class consciousness, like he's much more like Fichtean than he is Hegelian because of his way of conceiving of like the subject object, like creative personhood who just like goes out and makes the world like, and it's actually, he becomes more Hegelian in his later stuff where he's reflecting on that and trying to be like, oh, actually the process, like, you know, the process of the world really does create a distinction of separate like subject and object that is a part of the historical process, like in general kind of thing.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's, I think Hegelian is often used as a kind of general synonym
for
like idealist. This basically, this general synonym for the idea that like truth and freedom go together. Reality is a process of the realization of freedom. And truth, freedom, and like self-conscious subjectivity of one kind, or like self-conscious activity of one kind, like, are speculatively identical, as in like we see them as identical after the end of like the exposition of the system, right? Now, Yeah, you're absolutely right that, like, strictly speaking, this is like what the stuff I just said is like a set of memes, basically, that a bunch of different post-Kantian thinkers share, right, including Fichte and Schelling and so on and so forth. Like, everyone wants to say, ah, I have the system that, like, genuinely makes things come together. And yeah, absolutely right that, like, the version of this view that Lukács is closest to is this Fichtean idea of, like, there is an I or a single actor that makes this kind of thing, truth and freedom, come together, in, you know, brings about rational society. But yeah, I mean, I would just say, though, that, like, Lukács is just, I think the important thing is Lukács is not clear about any of this. I think that's like more the issue, that, like, he can sound Fichtean because he's, like, talking about revolution. He thinks of revolution as, like, an agent of this, right? But I think, like, there's more of a continuity between the earlier and the later positions, because the earlier positions I prefer to think of as, like, initial notes or, like, you know, like, polemical kind of, like, expositions of a tendency. So I think I might think of Lukács in using the generic notion of like idealist dialectics or something without being too specific about whether the dialectics are in the end Fichtean or in the end Hegelian. I don't think he was,
I think what was interesting to me is that it's, they were just saying, like, Lukács, when he starts to explicitly, like, quote Hegel more, is like, he actually claims that Hegel is what, like, addresses his over-subjectivism in his earlier text, because he uses a more explicit form of Hegelian dialectic to claim, like, oh, I didn't see that the separation of subject and object is a process of history which necessitates it through its own relationship, rather than his kind of earlier treatment of, like, the individual who is separated from the totality, but, like, really, like, the nature of the world as it should be would be that the proletariat will realize that they are object and subject at the same time, and then reintegrate themselves into the totality under which they, like, you know, that kind of, like, aspect.
You're thinking that the reason this is, like, the transition is, like, the subjectivism consists in the emphasis of the realization of the proletariat. It's like almost like cognitive intellectual realization, which is, that's the thing that does the work, right? So it's literally like someone coming to know something that brings it about. And so it's like,
because
I historical process,
like, I think, like, maybe we can go into more, like, the more famous, like, conceptual terms, which would probably be, you know, reification and then totality as, like, the kind of two big, and then, like, class consciousness is in there, and that's kind of, like, mediating, breaking this down. As I was thinking recently, there's an essay by Rob Lucas, who, he's, like, one of the EndNotes guys. It's called Feeding the Infant, and it's, I think he only posted it on Twitter. I haven't been able to find anywhere else that he's put it. I think it's technically an early draft of something, but, like, it's actually a pretty good essay where he also appeared on Swampside Chats and, like, was talking with them about it. It's kind of a good case of, like, actually, maybe this idea of totality is, like, not the best starting point in general for what we actually think we're talking about. But, like, he kind of just, like, put it, like, maybe it's wrongheaded of us to think that, like, we first need to say, like, capitalism is the world. That is what we are grounded upon. And therefore, like, there's, then you get into this weird language of, like, are we inside it? Are we outside it? Is it, like, what, like, where are you in the totality? And kind of, kind of that question of, like, do we need to get back into, like, maybe capitalism is something, like, in the world, like, it's relations. It's that it's, because I think that's one of the things that's interesting about people like Lukács and some of the other kind of critical thought that comes from this tradition is, I do feel like it can be so strong, but it does have this weird tendency of, like, things are reified. So part of, like, the process of analysis is to break down the reification into the relationships that are going on. But then, like, the pejorative category that's the reification is always, like, put forward as, like, oh, but you have to start with that thing. Like, you have to have that be, you know, like people will be like, oh, you're not being abstract enough because you need to start with, like, this abstraction. But it's like, yeah, but the only reason to bring the abstraction in is seemingly to break it down into the, like, relationships that are being analyzed. It makes me think of how I sometimes get frustrated with, like, in terms of the talk about, like, what makes something, you know, a Marxist analysis, you get this kind of stuff that it's like, you know, oh, I'm going to go do an analysis of, like, relations in I don't know, like household work, or like in, like maybe I'm an anthropologist. Maybe I'm going to go do an analysis of relations in like a village somewhere. And like people will be like, well, the thing that this isn't Marxist because you're not bringing in the category of value first. And it's kind of like, but the only reason to bring in value is to talk about like value is a thing that people recognize. Specifically, Marx is like often talking about value as something that people recognize in their exchange relationships. And it's also a category that political economists understand and realize is something going on, but they can only think of it as like a object that's in and of itself there. I don't know. That's the kind of thing. It's like you get this kind of like critical theory that's like, if you don't bring in value first as the foundational category of Marxist analysis, then you're already like disqualified. Well, isn't the point of that roar to be like to talk about this kind of, it's almost like the George Simmel point, like if you see any sort of like appearing self-evident object that appears to social actors, it's usually because there's like relationships going into it. Right. And they can see that you see the real pattern of relationships, but you don't necessarily see like all the relationships as relationships. You see them as like a social fact or object, like kind of thing. With this kind of stuff of that kind of, I think of in a Lukashian tradition, you see like even attempting to break it down often gets you in a weird point of like re-abstracting it into like this idea that like, oh, but then you just need to use them as analytical categories, which actually like kind of defeats the point, because like the critique is that political economists use stuff like value as just obvious analytical categories that are in the world. To me, that's one of the big paradoxes in this kind of Lukashian like critical theory approach often in my mind. Like, it's something that I struggle with too, which is why I think it's actually kind of interesting.
I mean, I was just going to say, I think it's useful. I think one thing's useful to get clear on is like the reason all these conversations happen is because they're like the Marxist heritage is like confused. And I mean, not confused, but kind of like incomplete, has all these different bits in it. It's like difficult to reconcile. And also there is this like perennial failure to kind of understand both what makes Marxism special and also the fact that it is like, in a way, like the fact that what makes it special is precisely like what also makes it difficult to like render systematic. Mm-hmm. So everyone has different views on this, but for me, like just to put it out there, the three big things that we get from Marx, I mean, this is me writing a big IOU, is like, and I'll spell them out in a way that shows exactly how they're open-ended and why they seem to require mm-hmm. just like methodological. But yeah, it's like, roughly speaking, there's the idea of materialism, which is extremely unclear in the original writings. The idea, I think the way I interpret it, the minimal way, is like, when theorizing, you should be guided by quote-unquote the real, which is mm-hmm. connected with like the sensuous, the perceptible. Like there's this idea of like, look, you as a theorist are a human being stuck in like determinate material relations, which involve you mm-hmm. in determinate relations to other people and to nature, right? And these relations are like the inescapable starting point for theory, right? Like mm-hmm. theory has to be about those things, right? So that's like materialism, right? It's a much, you know, open-ended idea mm-hmm. of like reality as the kind of like embeddedness of these sensuous material.
It's a little, I mean, this is a problematic tradition in a lot of senses, but like to me, it's kind of like almost more like pragmatic materialism in a way.
Absolutely.
It's like the idea that like you're in your existence, you're in media res.
Absolutely.
Like, and there's stuff around you, like that's what you're dealing with. Like
I would say, I mean, I would just call it, go back to the heritage of the pragmatists and call it Kantian, that there is like, you know, which
yeah.
is so that's materialism. The big question that raises is just like, okay, great, why is your sensuous embodiment like that important, right? Like, and people have different answers to this. So that's like the first problem, right? Materialism, the real natural embodiment, this kind of in medias res thing, right? So that's like something we get, as it were, from the holy texts themselves, right? This is like, I think the thing I'm thinking of most when I say this is like the German ideology. Like that's why mm-hmm. that's where this comes out. But it's everywhere, really.
Yeah.
Right. So that's like the first thing. The second thing is value critique, right? Which is like a very, very specific project, which is that like and a critical debunking of the object of political economy, right? So the thought is, right, like bourgeois political economy acts like it's this like substantial science, that it's like studying this object called value, and it's studying various categories understood in terms of this like self-standing object called value, like capital and rent and labor and so on and so forth, right? And value critique, or critique of, I should just call it the critique of political economy, says, no, that's not the object. That's merely what the object appears to be. The object is fetishized social relations, right? Social relations, which like present themselves as something they're not, right? Quote, objectively present themselves as something they're not, right? And very roughly, there is some idea that like this, the alienated or fetishistic character of like, you know, value mediated like forms of labor, right, is irrational somehow, right? And this gets into like the Marxism ethics series of conversations, right, where it's like, look, this process of taking concrete labor and use values and like, you know, mediating them in abstract values, like in the aggregate, it produces a process where like rational people trying to interact with nature to fulfill their needs in a rational way, are being subject to this process, which is irrational, i.e. driven only by the increase of surplus value and accumulation and so on and so forth, right? So that's value critique. And like, it just, all it does is it takes this single object called value and says, that's not the object of a science, dissolves it into this like contradictory structure of like these interconnected social practices, right? And contradictory because irrational, right? The notion of a contradiction, I think, is like always in bed with like some idea that like the real is the rational, right? That like the reason one form of life, so one, I shouldn't say form of life, one kind of, one social practice is contradictory is because what is its rational organization is somehow being suppressed, right? It wants to break out somehow. And that, yeah, that's how it ought to be, right? Not just ought to be in the ethical sense, but ought to be in some kind of like metaphysical sense.
Right.
So the fact that capitalism doesn't satisfy human needs, I'm using that as like a placeholder for like whatever it is.
Right.
You know, whatever the use value side of the contradiction is supposed to be, right? That's not just supposed to be some kind of like, you know, bad thing. It's supposed to be something that like should tell you that like capitalism is like a metaphysical aberration somehow. Like it's weird that it continues to exist, right? Anyway, so we have got single materialism. We've got this kind of weird idea of like contradiction, socially irrational form of like labor, right? And then we've got this idea of like theorizing as an expression of like a revolutionary class, which is also present in Marx, which is like, look, Marx didn't come up with class struggle. He's very explicit about this. Bourgeois writers have conceptions of class struggle. They even have conceptions of crisis of one sort or another, right? Marx takes, I mean, I don't remember what quote this is, but if you, I can dig it up after for the listeners, about like Marx saying at some point that like his distinctive contribution is the discovery of like revolutionary proletariat, right? Or the conception of like class struggle as like revolutionary class struggle, struggle over social form, right? So we have a notion of reflexivity in that very thing, right? Like theory is supposed to be the expression of a revolutionary consciousness. And this idea of revolution, which is the third thing in the trifecta, is like, you know, that comes through in the political writings, that comes through in the critique of the Goethe program, all these other places, right? The problem is all of these three, like the kind of ultimate basis of all of these three things is kind of completely unclear, right? Yeah. It's like this kind of, it's not, this is not to deny that like these three things, I believe in these three things, you know, obviously, but like, what is material reality? That's the big question for, if you know what to think about materialism. What is this notion of like implicit idea of like rationality, or, you know, like the way the, in value critique, like the, or humanness, right? Like that's supposed to be sometimes the way like it's articulated, right? It's like, but I will use rationality, even though like it, their Adonian concerns about.
Or the other thing you could probably frame it as in a way would be like with Lukács, it's like the alienation of human activity from its exactly. like full realization in a way that is, you know, a rational or like more holistically competent kind of behavior. Right.
And I think the tricky thing about what I'm suggesting here is that I'm saying that there is some formal or structural equivalent to the notion of alienation in Capital. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously that's like contentious, right?
Yeah.
I definitely don't think I'm sort of like gesturing at like hostile people here. Like, I'm not saying there's like a full-blown notion of species being or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm literally just saying that like the way Marx expresses the contradictory nature of like alienated labor does involve some idea of for want of a better word, individual irrationality mediated badly by the social form it's in.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's always how you express these things, right? It's like you're trying to do things to satisfy human needs, or you're trying at an individual level to like do what you're told or participate in the, you know, and then at the social level, all of those things are like distorted or fetishized or something like that, right? It's like,
yeah.
But I think the question still arises that like, okay, how do you, you know, you can express this kind of contradiction in like a not terribly interesting way, which is just like, you know, this idea of like in economics is fallacy of composition, right? Like, you know, Keynesians have long described the difference between like microeconomics and macroeconomics in terms of like individual rational agents, like making decisions, which as a collective lead to adverse outcomes, right? Like that can't be what's, just that structure can't be what's distinctive about value critique. Like really what it has to be some very strong idea that like, look, capitalism calls into being forms of like agency and activity, rationality that it then denies somehow.
Yeah.
Right? There's got to be a stronger notion of the, like what's driving the contradictory nature of the social form than just, oh, people want good things and they act so as to want good things and then bad things happen.
Right? Yeah. Well, because like with the Keynesian example, it's like the Keynesian solution is usually that there is some implicit way that like, once we understand the trends of too many people wanting this thing or that thing, or we understand that economic agents respond to their animal spirits. So when they see a certain pattern, they instinctively act in their interest or whatever. Like their solution is usually a variation on like, you just use mediation of political power, or like you just restructure where like the capital like flow basically is to just like kind of be a countervailing tendency against what the individual actors will do. Right. And like the kind of Marxian point is like the very idea that the actors do this thing is already like it involves a ton of social stuff that can't just be mediated through like the presumed thing that they're trying to do. Like the whole motive that they are acting upon is kind of the problem in the first place. It's not just that there's not enough like of this other instrumental mediation of like those motives. Like
that's absolutely, I'm glad you said that, because in a way the problem is like, why is it a problem? And it's like difficult to say without bringing in the idea of revolution that like, look, because the big question, I mean in a way this kind of prior question is like, okay, what's wrong with these initial motives, right? And often the answers are not super convincing because they're just like, well, they're instrumental, but like, you know, and it's so the way often this kind of this like the, you know, the nature of alienated social forms is glossed is in a way that's like very unconvincing. It's like, well, people act in a coordinated way so as to produce outcomes that are different from their motives, right? That's clearly not, that's not going to do as a definition. Or people, you know, that's just like a, for want of a better word, like what game theoretical people would call like a coordination failure. That's like not super interesting. I think it really, as you say, I mean, I really do think that some kind of idea that like, look, there is something really bad about the kind of way, in a way, the question is like, what is bad about a social form that's fetishized, right? And in other words, what is bad about, like, in what way is it irrational in some like deep way. Like, in what way does it, like, disobey the law of non-contradiction?
Yeah.
Anyway, I bring that up only to say, like, this is a big open question. And, like, how to theorize that is a big open question. And then the revolution stuff, that's also, like, okay, great. Who is the bearer of revolutionary subjectivity? Is that even a concept we want to use? How do we read revolutionary intent off of, like, sociology, right? Is that, you know, so in a sense, what's wrong with fetishism? What is material reality and what is revolution? These are these, like, big unanswered questions, right? And unanswered, it's important to, I mean, obviously, it's not that Marx can't say anything about these things. The point is simply that, like, we don't have a kind of systematic understanding of, like, how to give a content to these categories. What does systematic mean here? Like, why do we need a systematic understanding, right? It's more just like, when debates happen over these categories, it's hard to know exactly how to resolve them outside the, like, circumscribed context that, like, Marx is deploying them, right? So it's like, one kind of question is like, well, what is a real materialist approach, right? Is it, like, is the social science thing incompatible with that, et cetera, et cetera? Similarly, why not think, you know, you could just think like, well, capitalism is a social system that produces bad outcomes relative to some, like, independent moral standard, like justice or what have you, right? Because you might just think like, look, whatever this kind of irrationality is, it's not clear what it is. But we spent 20 minutes talking about it. I mean, I haven't. Often Marxists will just default to, like, it produces war and crises and waste of resources, like Marcuse, very standard Marcuse kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
And it should be like hand wave. That just should just tell you what the bad kind of irrationality is, right? And then this question of revolution, right, which is like, who's the revolutionary subject? Where does it come from, et cetera? And, like, these questions are not impossible to answer, like, to core. It's just more that, like, Marx thinks of theory as an expression of revolution as its, like, own special thing. It's not supposed to be a stand-in for some, like, independent idea of, like, political strategy or, like, organization theory or something like that. No, it's supposed to be, like, you know, theory as revolution is supposed to be connected to this, like, stuff about, you know, getting away from irrationality, demolishing the irrational social form, et cetera, et cetera. Right. But that's famously Marx's concept. You know, it's famously quite difficult to determine, like, outside a revolutionary situation, what the objective determinants of the revolutionary situation are. Right. So this idea of a theory as an expression of revolution seems very much like this circular kind of, like, you know, a perpetual motion engine, which is like, So just to tie it all up, all of these things are, quote, the genuine Marxist views. But the problem is just that, like, it's very hard to make systematic sense of them in a way that, like, you know, anyway, so hence Lukács is, I guess, like, my thought. It's like, this is what he's trying to do. He's trying to tie all of these things up in a little bow, right? And trying to, like, rebut all of these other perspectives on thought and reality and philosophy and so on. He's trying to say, look, here is what materialism is. Here is what, like, here's what's bad about fetishized social relations. Here is how revolution happens. And it's all one thing, which is the self-activity of the proletariat. Like, that is the one answer that will tell you what all of these things are, right? Materialism is the study of the self-activity of history. History is ultimately the story of the self-activity of the proletariat. What's wrong with fetishism? Well, it blocks the self-activity of the proletariat, right? It blocks this amazing rational society that we'll get. So you see, all of those tricky questions we had earlier about, like, saying what's wrong about fetishism other than, like, in these, like, functional terms, it generates crisis, you can just defer those questions. And then what's revolution? Well, it's when
to be fair, a lot of Marx's, I do feel like a lot of Marx's justifications for, like, why, like, you know, why, like, why should the proletariat have a revolution? A lot of his answers at the time were, well, they're having one. So like, look, the proletariat is engaging in a coordinated class struggle right now outside my window. Like, of course.
There you go. No, actually. But the crucial thing is, it's important to note, like, empiricist Marxist listening in, Lukács' notion of the proletariat can't be understood apart from its role in solving all these problems, right? Mm-hmm. Lukács is emphatic that, like, there's no sociological reduction. Like, the proletariat is supposed to, like, when you ask, like, well, what is the proletariat? Well, it's the thing that emerges from the class conflict of capitalism that creates a revolution that's, and specifically, what is a revolution? It's the thing that's supposed to get rid of the irrational social totality. That's a, yeah. What is rationality? Well, just defer back to
it's what those proletarians are doing is the rationality, you know.
Right. And I bring this up like not necessarily to make fun. I mean, I don't consider any of this like a decisive objection to Lukács. It's just like, this is just what the view is. Like, he does think that you are not going to be able to understand these central concepts of Marxism completely and systematically unless you're kind of doing this thing. Like, in some sense, unless you're in the middle of a revolution. There are no sociological, like, there is no way of sociologically refuting Lukács, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, unless you're the party. If you're the party and you tell him that he's wrong, then you might be able to refute him, because he'll go, well, the proletariat that tells the party that gives the rationality of the proletarian expression is telling me I'm wrong, therefore I must be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is the strange thing. I mean, this is why this structure is, like, so hostile to, like, being a kind of ideology for a particular party organ, right? That's like, you know, there's the famous thing about, like, oh, Marxists talk about dialectics, but there's some suspicion that, like, dialectics is just a way of, like, you know, my friends are right about everything, right? Yeah. It's just like this perpetual motion machine that's supposed to be, you know. I think that's unfair. I think what's happening is just like when, Lukács' whole problem in a way here is that, like, he wants to say, like, the full content of Marxist theory is derived from, like, the intellectual self-consciousness of a political movement which is defined by the fact that it solves all the intellectual problems I care about. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, you know, it's like, well, the proletariat is the thing that is struggling with, you know, the dialectic of art and life, the dialectic of, you know, the everyday and the Heideggerian authentic or whatever, yeah. Right? Or, you know, and the dialectic of thought and being and Descartes' problem of skepticism and all this kind of stuff. That, like, there is some thought that, like, you know, full rationality is what will happen as human beings develop, like, ways of resolving these problems, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, it's very, very difficult to get your head around, because any notion you try to, like, pin on, which, like, is supposed to help you understand the structure, it's like, oh, freedom. I know what he's talking about. Like, so revolution is the thing that's supposed to bring freedom. Well, part of the issue is that freedom is understood in terms of this idea of, like, you know, rationality. Like, freedom is connected with, like, rationality, and rationality is connected with freedom. So it's like, what counts as a free society is one which is, okay, we know at least negatively what it is, right? It's supposed to be, you have a social power, which is, like, not determining itself by the imperatives of the capitalist social power. Mm-hmm. So that much we know. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. There's also,
we know that it has some sort of free association of people that are not private laborers and owners, like,
right. I mean, free is so right, but then that just brings this, like, further question of, like, what counts as a free
society? Yeah, yeah.
Right, which is this, and of course, Marxists will say, "Oh, no, the deviation into kind of, like, bourgeois political philosophy, where you kind of try to answer what notion of freedom,
a constitution is of the communist society." Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I don't know. People sometimes cite the cookshops of the future line as, like, I don't think that's quite what the objection. It's more just like, look, we can't tell you what these concepts mean outside of, like, this particular context, mm-hmm, struggle, right? So it's like, well, look, in society, people struggle over the meaning of concepts, right? This is sadly, you know, this is a way of putting things that, like, the way my supervisor would put it, that, like, you know, i.e. a lib kind of way. You know, people struggle over values that they share, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of, I mean, it is kind of the thought here, which is like, you know, and so the thought is, we're not really going to tell you what freedom is beyond the fact that, like, in this concrete struggle, you know, bourgeois forces are aligned in one area and, like, proletarian forces are aligned in the other area and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. And it's like, but part of the issue is that might make you think that, like, the sociology of class will help you out here. That, like, mm-hmm. oh, if I can only figure out what proletariat and bourgeois mean, I can answer all these questions, right? Because Lukács keeps telling me to, like, go back to the class struggle, right? Yeah. But of course, class struggle is not this independent foothold either.
Yeah.
Because Lukács defines proletariat and bourgeois kind of circularly with reference to this revolution, you know, the struggle mm-hmm. against fetishism. So the proletariat, ultimately, it's not that he doesn't think the proletariat is, like, you know, the oppressed class or the class which
yeah.
Needs to, you know, have wages in order to work. It's that the ultimate meaning, the kind of for itself meaning of the proletariat, mm-hmm. right, is like the people who have the real ability to overcome mm-hmm. irrationality. That's like the yeah. role they play in the system, right? But of course, we wanted to figure out what irrationality was by kind of, like, going back to
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there is this real thing about, like, it isn't just that you can only figure out what Lukács means in the context of a revolution. It's that you can only figure out what Lukács means if you can somehow place yourself in a revolutionary context where the things he thinks are at stake mm-hmm. are actually at stake.
Right? Yeah.
That it's a revolution between socialism and barbarism in all of the rich senses, right? It's like,
right. You
know, it's a revolution where some people want the novel to be transcended and some people want, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's I think, like, that's my very long-winded answer to your question about, like, what do I do with these categories of reification? Like, you know, the reason it's not so much that they have to be put first, it's that their proper explanation can only be given, like, circularly. There's mm-hmm. no way of, like, completely explaining them with reference to, like, these common sense forms of thought.
Rationality, maybe we'll close off with this. Because I think one of the things about rationality and Lukács, and to some extent in the Frankfurt School, that's kind of, like, hard to get at, is because it's, like, it's rationality that's, you know, he's opposing it to, like, what he takes from Weber of the, you know, the calculating, instrumental, quantitating version of rationality, which I think he, you know, I think one of the big criticisms of him is that he's overextending what Marx's critique of value fetishism is into, like, this, like, wider, like, almost, like, ontological cognitive, like, problem. I don't know how exactly to put it. It kind of makes it unclear because it's like, yeah, the actual rationality of the proletariat does have this kind of, like, eschatological thing that, like, it's defined by the fact that in the end you're going to get this rational society, and that's what makes it rational.
And if you ask what makes that society rational, if you ask for what that means, well, you're deferred back to whatever yeah. the people are struggling for.
Yeah. Know? There's a reason that Lukács is oddly enough, like, the precursor to the problems with a lot of standpoint theory, that it's like, you get into this thing of, like, well, it's not a problem to say that, like, people have a sense of what they're doing and experience of what they're doing, but it's when you get into the question of, like, well, why do they have a privileged explanation and goal for, like, what's going to happen because of that position. I think this was making me think of, even though he critiques history and class consciousness, this kind of discussion of rationality is something that does continue through his work, including his aesthetic work. Because, like, in the essays we read for the podcast, he's, like, critiquing German expressionism. You know, Ernst Bloch is like, look at German expressionism. Sometimes it's reactionary, but it's also this, it's an example of, you know, individuals trying to present the agonies of the time, the contradictions of the time. And Lukács is like, yes, that's there, but the work itself is irrational, and therefore we can't, you know, we can't accept it. Like, it's deviating from, like, what actual, like, rational understanding of totality should be. And I've been thinking about this because I think I mentioned before, I think it's really weird that, like, destruction of reason got a new Verso edition. And I feel like every time I see people talk about Lukasz on social media, they're talking about how great that book is. Mm. And I'm like, is it really that? Which part of it is, I think that there's just like this big anti-Nietzsche thing that's going on. Mm. But it's interesting to me to like look at this, because I'm like, I don't think that a lot of these people have really tried to, I think it's funny because I think a lot of these people don't actually have an account of what rationality is, except that they understand that Lukasz gives you kind of a get out of jail free card by just saying, you know, like, oh, like these people, like, you know, these people that talk about the irrationality of whatever, like they're just getting it wrong because the proletariat is rational and is doing things rationally. Right. But like they flip flop between like it's rationality, meaning like the proletariat has a pure understanding of things, or if it just means that like the proletariat's immediate essential needs are necessary to understand for what they're going to do as a class. Like they don't actually like have an account of it. They just kind of like that Lukasz gives you a reason to say these Nietzschean Marxists are wrong, which there's a lot of Nietzschean Marxism stuff that I don't like either. Right. And I don't like it when people cling on to saying they're irrational to mean that they don't need to produce any clarity in their arguments. I get that. But I also think it's like you could kind of do the same thing. Like you can claim that you're being super rational and reasonable. Lukasz is an example of how you can try to be super clear and founded and reasonable, but also not ever need to really say like outside of like your self-enclosed system, theoretically, like where it goes really like, but I don't know. I guess I was kind of like curious if you had any, it doesn't seem like you're as plugged into Left Book or anything anymore, but I kind of wonder if you had any intuitions about why you think this kind of phenomenon would be popping off all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, I think to defend Lukasz slightly from my own attacks, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with like his understanding that he's in this like world, as you say, world historical kind of conjuncture. Mm-hmm. I think the reason that he thinks that like the proletariat is this movement that is, to put it simply, going to solve every problem is that like that's what it seems like in the struggle, that mm-hmm. like there are, you know, revolutionary aspirations are built in the struggle, which can't be given full content until they're realized, right? Like it just is the case that like, you know, in the early 20s there was, for want of a better word, all kinds of critical tendencies in all of these mm-hmm. different areas, right? Like there was, people just did engage in productive activity in like, you know, science and art and, you know, novel writing and so on and so forth, which had this kind of like socialist form. And they're like, Lukasz, the difficulty just is that like outside that context, it's just not the, you know, mm-hmm. the theoretical enterprise is like not that useful for us. Like, you know, it just isn't the case that like, there is something in the same way as there was in like Central Europe, like in Lukács' context, there is this like general consensus about what the cultural problems of the day are, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there isn't the same novel reading culture, right? You know, Sally Rooney notwithstanding, right? Like it's, you know, mm-hmm. There isn't the same kind of like, you know, consensus on like artistic forms, exceptional artistic beauty and all this kind of stuff, right? So just like, Lukasz is really thinking in struggle. It's not so much that his system is self-enclosed, but his system is a kind of bet on mm-hmm. a movement, right? And so outside that context, demanding independent clarification is kind of impossible. And like that helps us, I think, answer your question about Left Book, which is that taking on Lukaczian categories is a little bit like cosplaying, right? Is a little mm-hmm. like pretending that you're still in this context where there's this like imminent struggle about, which potentially, implicitly, hopefully, about like the possibility of a completely enlightened society or the possibility of a completely rational society. But like, I think the charitable way of reading people like Lukasz is that like their works kind of gesture about what it felt like to be in this encompassing struggle, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're like, you didn't know where it was going quite, but you felt that it was really important to have thought that engaged with the massive scope of what felt like was going on, you know, mm-hmm. That you wouldn't be doing full justice to like the ambitions of like the struggles around you if you were to dilute them, you know, it really, mm-hmm. people really did think at the time the riddle of history is solved, and like Lukács is giving expression to like what that thought could be. I think the difficulty, and here just Adorno is just, I think right here, is just that like, look, it isn't that Lukács refuted in that sense. I mean, this is just the point of like a theory mm-hmm. that has like practical success conditions, right? It's like, you know, it's that the kind of movement that he imagined was in place just wasn't in place. And it is very convenient for us to defer back to that movement because there is a kind of revolutionary excitement that like feels like it obviates the need for any kind of like criticism, right? It's like the feeling when there's a movement in place that like feels like it has both the strength and the scope to give you, you know, solve the human history, then it's just like, it feels like the theoretical task is to cheer that movement up.
Yeah, yeah.
And to give it like the, you know, and to kind of like give it its like rightful historical place. Like in the absence of that, the seductive thing about Lukács though is that like, there are things in him that like are easy to like, that like, as you say, mm-hmm. he just kind of solves every problem for you, right? And the difficulty of like Lukács' heritage is that we are still in some way concerned with all of these like literary, artistic, political problems mm-hmm. that he cares about, that they haven't just disappeared.
Yeah. Right?
The problem is just that, one, we don't have a revolutionary struggle of any kind, let alone a like a Hegelian revolution of the one he was looking kind mm-hmm. of looking for, right? Because remember, even Lukács was to some extent, like in history and classical consciousness, somewhat optimistic about his circumstances, right? Like it's yeah. like not just, it isn't just that, like it was clear that some kind of political revolution was going on. There's further debate about whether it was a proletarian revolution,
yeah.
how long it was a proletarian, et cetera. But Lukács, remember, wants to make this further step that it was this like world historical Hegelian revolution.
Yeah.
Right. And this not everyone would have said. Lenin himself would not have yeah. said that this was yeah. like necessarily, you know. So it's just with him, you just get there are these things that he's kind of the first person to say. He's kind of the first person to tie all this into a bow, like try to answer all these kinds of foundational questions, tries to integrate that with the politics and so on. And I think what's seductive is like Lukács's aspiration, if not necessarily the way he carried it out. Like he does mm-hmm. want to say that, look, the imminent problems of this movement are the problems of humanity. And if the movement can succeed, humanity's problems will be solved. Right. That's still very attractive, obviously, mm-hmm. because, you know, we still want to integrate theory of practice in some kind of way. We still want to, you know, try to say that like all of these long-standing problems, which don't immediately seem like they have a lot to do with value critique, are also going to be solved by our favorite
yeah. people,
right? It's like, you know, we're also going to obviate the need for religion. We're also going to resolve racism, or mostly resolve racism,
yeah.
you know? So it is this kind of like all-in-one thing, right? But it's also encouraged. I mean, I think the difficulty I'm having is like saying exactly what Lukács got wrong, because
yeah.
I mean, other than just the obvious, like the movement he talked about has disappeared. But it's just more like, I mean, this is the kind of Adorno space about like, Lukács' problems didn't go away completely. And the ghosts of his problems still remain, in the sense of, you know, we still feel like asking questions about modernity. We still feel like asking questions about like the decline of religion and the needs that it serves. We still, you know, all of these kinds of big picture questions of the conjuncture still remain. It's just that I suppose they're no longer fused with class contestation in the same way, right?
Yeah.
Questions of nation, questions of identity, questions of religion are not intrinsically like or naturally class questions in the way mm-hmm. Lukács might have thought they would
yeah.
work this time.
I mean,
so, yeah.
It kind of makes me think of like a group I'm somewhat like inspired and influenced by is like a lot of the like Italian like Barresimo type, you know, stuff, which is like, you know, like Mario Tronti's Workers in Capital reads in a lot of ways like a very Lukashian kind of like 68er like text. But you kind of like, as you look at sort of what I consider to be a, like a devolvement of that movement, I feel like what you see is like, it's not just that it's cosplaying. It's like this idea that like, okay, like we're clearly not in the same moment anymore. So what we need to do is we need to find like other little things in society and show that actually these are already related to what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And therefore it can be revolutionary if we like, you know, that kind of like you can look to something else and just go, well, that's a value relationship with class struggle in it. And so, you know, like you shouldn't see yourself as opposed to what we're doing. Like you're already in on it, man. Like, and it kind of like, you know, like sometimes you see people that do the super semi-rigorous, like extended analysis of like how this one type of labor over here relates into this other thing that goes back on. And then at the end of the day, it's a value relationship, but like it often feels a little bit like you're just trying to get everyone on your side again by insisting that actually it's already in your analysis if you just extend it.
You like, move from everything is necessarily connected and mediated to everything is like one problem, which will
all be
the same stride. Like, yeah, and it's just not it's just like apparently not the case that it's like, this is the strange way of like, Van and I tried to figure out for a while, like, what is the death of Marxism exactly? Because like, you know, like what exactly went away in like the loss of in the 30s or the 40s or whenever the death happened, people disagree, right? And it's like we want to say the working class movement, but well, strikes are back now. Does that mean the working class movement is back? It's like, well, no. Is it just that they have to get more organized and like coordinated? Is that what's required? It's like, well, we had that in the 70s and people were still, you know, like even Operaismo is a kind of crisis of Marxism, what's going on
with
the movement, right? This is the strange thing. It's like, you know, so it's not as if it's, you know, and then you realize like the difficulty is we keep being ushered back to this Lukachian moment because we still live in a capitalist totality. Everything still feels like it's socially mediated, by one thing, or at least like capitalism, you know, value relations seem to show up everywhere in some way, but somehow the social world doesn't have this kind of like polarized structure that Lukács wanted to have, where it's like, yes, value relations are everywhere, but that doesn't seem to be what like, and this is going to sound too idealist, but like, I mean, I'm sure there's a more materialist formulation of what I'm about to say, but like, that's not what seems to be at stake in
struggle. Yeah.
Like, despite the fact that value is everywhere, the way value is taken up in forms of political struggle and class consciousness is not, as it were, you know, unified and properly revolutionary. And it's not even, this is the strange thing, it's not even like trade union consciousness or something, right? It's not even just like, well, there is deficient revolutionary consciousness. You know what I mean? It's like, it's sort of like something else. It's like, you know, forms of value seem to develop forms of struggle which don't adequately apprehend their social basis and sort of seem not to need to in order to reproduce themselves, right? Like, political struggles seem not to care about whether either side grasps the social totality. They seem to proceed along fine without needing to, right?
Yeah.
And obviously Marxists will say, well, who cares? It's our job to make them do that, right? And it's like, but okay, fine. I mean, that's like, that's, you can say that, but the whole point of the system was that like, we were supposed to just like, not completely just read it off what people are doing, but like we're supposed to engage with how things are, you know. And so we have this weird thing where like a reified form of social being where, but without correspondingly reification focused forms of political struggle, right? In that context, I'm not even sure like reification is the word to use because I'm not sure if that's But yeah, you see what I mean? Like, I know mm-hmm. what you're talking about when you're talking about, like, I mean, I've read Viewpoint articles that are like this. Like, when you were talking, I was thinking of, like, Kinsey Arruza and, like, social reproduction theory mm-hmm. style stuff, right? It's like, ah, well, we have found that gender dynamics are intrinsically implicated in, like, the mm-hmm. value of production. Great. Does that mean that...
Yeah.
And obviously,
does that mean that the interests of, like, women who are proletarianized is going to merge into the, like, you almost I think that's what's kind of funny, is that it presupposes, again, like, you get into this kind of thing of, like, well, is the proletariat as a category, like, are we talking about it as a fetishized object? Like, do we treat it as, like, you know, like, I have, like, my laptop here and that's a thing, and then there in the world there's a thing that is called the proletariat. That, like it sounds like, you know, everyone kind of does, like, a mecha, like, thing, and then, like, goes and, like, smashes everything.
Like Gundam, yeah, that's
yeah, right. Like, you know, actually, like, yeah. The question, like, is the realization that, like, this group of people who go through, you know, what we call, like, proletarianizing relationships, like, if they consider themselves having, like, some sort of interest that isn't aligned with, like, these other people, like, can we just go, oh, it's a fetishization that just... You know, like, and once you get rid of the fetishization, they're gonna operate together because the proletarian rationality takes hold.
I think it's a little bit with the post-operists. Like, I'm thinking of what you referred to very, like, delicately as, like, the degeneration of that tradition. Like, if I was thinking of, like, loosely speaking, like, the people who say feminist struggle, workplace struggle, et cetera, are all part of the same thing, and, like, yeah. You have a sense of the kind of person I'm gesturing at, who's, like, mm-hmm. post-operas and, like, mm-hmm. cares a lot about social reproduction, cares a lot about, like, mm-hmm. racism, as, you know, I'm thinking, like, Spectre magazine is also kind of, like,
yeah.
in this tradition.
But, which, I mean, I think I want to be clear. Like, I think there are people who take influence by this stuff and do good work. Like, I think there are people who do good stuff on, like, social reproduction in the sense of just being like, actually, the working class and dynamics, like, it has a lot of stuff that you do have to look at, like, how these people relate in, like, a household thing. And, like, a lot of workers now do household labor. Like, that part is fine. It's more, I think, yeah, the way that it gets justified in this idea of, like, this giant movement is, like, where it gets kind of weird, because it kind of feels like it's like backtrack. They're like, oh, well, if we talk about this issue, and then we backtrack enough to show that it's actually related to this thing that we're already talking about as our core, then actually they're just the same thing.
The thing that we're all kind of gesturing at here is that, like, Marxism is, like, the Lukácsian aspiration is that, like, Marxism is fundamentally, like, a theory of revolution that brings about full rationality. And full rationality is, like, the progressive resolution of, like, contradictions in society. And, like, to preempt the Adornian complaint, like, this doesn't mean you visualize a single state where, like, all of these things are reconciled. It's more just, like, this, what seems to be at stake in the struggle right now mm-hmm. is the interconnected resolution of all of these separate things, mm-hmm. right? So it's not as, like, unmotivated yeah. and weird as people have believe. The difficulty is just that, like, contemporary revolutions contemporary struggles, don't seem to be intrinsically conceptually related, right? Mm-hmm. As in you can relate them, but, like, that requires active political work and transformation.
Yeah.
And so, right. You know, so for instance, like, you know, big trade unions and, like, gay rights activists and so on and so forth. You know, the Democratic Party does provide some kind of base where, like, those people can mm-hmm. come together. But of course, that the Democratic Party is not a rational translation of the, like, intrinsic mm-hmm. interests of all these people. Right? So one, there's, like, a lack of integration between these, like, forms of struggle. Mm-hmm. Two, the way these forms of struggle are integrated is not under the banner of Lukácsian rationality.
Right? Yeah. So,
like, it is of course true that, for example, in Brooklyn, right, like, people who are literary critics who have left mm-hmm. and, like, it is a fact that, like, people from all around the culture are leftists, but that, like, the fact that they come together in that way isn't necessarily reflective of this like underlying Lukacian society is polarized between the enemies of reason, which is the bourgeoisie, and like, you know. And really we want to recapture we want to recapture the integration of the proletariat in terms of the integration of this like interests of all the oppressed people. And we also want the interests of all the oppressed people to be an expression of a desire for full rationality, right? It's like the problem is not necessarily with the idea of like a theory of revolution. The problem is we wanting revolution to do a whole bunch of different things, right? And as a result, like the thing that's supposed to be a basis of Marxism, the philosophy of revolution, becomes ambiguous in this important way where like, you know, some people just think, these groups are disunited. I should just say all of these people are the people who've been unjustly treated by the system and unite around that. Or all of these people are people who want freedom, unite around that. But then, you know, the fucking anti-lockdown people want freedom. You know, all these kinds of questions. And I think the issue is just that Lukács allows you to answer these questions really straightforwardly. Right? Everyone agrees that we have to get our philosophical commitments out of our politics, right? And ideally what we want philosophically is everything tied into a neat little bow. So wouldn't it be nice if we could divide society into our side and their side, and that division also mapped onto all of the philosophical and moral problems we care about in society, right? So in a nutshell, that is why being a Lukacian is really tempting, right?
Yeah.
Because it's one-stop shop for all your political problems.
To be fair, when you were mentioning, you know, some of the stuff of why Lukács is appealing, I will say for a 20th century guy writing about Thomas Mann, he's pretty... He does that thing that you can like read it. It's like line by line. It always feels like, boom, building this thing, next line, but it's going somewhere. And this is the thing. And you're like, yeah. But then you have to think about it and be like, well, that only holds if I follow your argument line by line. Like, you know, like that, that's why it read so well, is that I was on board with you with each sentence. But then like, I have to look at like how this sentence is backed up by this one back here. And like, and then you kind of get into this question about like, it's going to sound really appealing if you are in a situation where it's like, yeah, you're in a revolution, you have the, or if you're someone sitting there going, man, I wish I was in a revolution, and you want to read what it sounds like when someone is like,
it's the unity of theory and practice that's like really the thing here. It's like Lukács is pouncing on this really attractive idea that there is a form of thinking about the world which will also achieve all kinds of practical goals you want to achieve, right? And the unity of theory and practice is like a hope. That is the basis of the project. It's a project that begins with an aspiration, right? It's not that you're trying to make true, you're just trying to make like true or false statements about the world. You're trying to understand the world so as to change it, theses on Feuerbach, right? Horkheimer, all these critical theorists, they note that this idea is not unique to Marxism, practice, right? They go all the way back to Plato and Aristotle and say that like, the dialogues were supposed to be also this unity of theory and practice. It's the thing that makes Marxism unique is that it's supposed to take like the unity of theory and practice, all of the goals of theory and practice that philosophers would have wanted to have, achieve a good life, you know, achieve this maximal understanding of the world, and shows you how to achieve that philosophically souped up notion of the unity of theory and practice in modern society, right? So that's like the kind of, you know, the project stands or fails if you buy into the hope. I think people want that hope, but it's kind of like, it doesn't feel, I keep wanting to say something like it's refuted or society doesn't have the basis for it, but you can't refute a project, you know what I mean? You can only show it's unproductive.
It is I don't know, I do feel like there's something to like I feel like a lot of the people that are the most interesting proponents of a Marxist project or like research project or whatever, like it's these people that kind of are able to do this like line of like, there's a bit of truth to this, like kind of like on the one hand, like the kind of like the post-Marxist whole thing, like what they were talking about is like a reality of where we ended up, like,
yeah.
But it's kind of also able to go, but like, but also, what does this do? Like, it's like, yeah.
The problem with post-Marxism, right, is that we weren't sure about what Marxism was, so it's like not clear exactly how to go past it.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of that stuff about like, we need a new hope or whatever. That like kind of reads a little like wishy-washy. But
we just weirdly replicate the structure of Lukács' view without dialectical materialism, right?
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of hard to say where to go, but I do think that one of the things that was interesting, I was like, not that I really think that their political project per se is going to like lead the revolution either, but I think one of the interesting things about some group like, you know, Endnotes, on the one hand, they're sort of like the post-operismo thing, they're like championing like, you know, all this much more like diffuse. But on the other hand, even though they're like communizers, they are kind of willing to be like, we're not going to pretend that this is all going to just be the same thing.
Right.
Like, we can't say that this group is automatically joining in with like this other one. That's not the point of our attempt to understand what is revolutionary about like forms of struggle today.
Right.
Which I think is like one of the things that made them so like kind of interesting when they like, I mean, I don't know, some of their more recent stuff, I feel like they're kind of realizing like, something's changed in the times, but like I think that was kind of what stood out like in this kind of late 90s early 2000s like thing, to like make that point and then be like, but we're gonna still try to do like a rigorous, you know, value critique and all that stuff, but like we can't have this kind of assumption as our like faith-based we can have the faith in like revolutionary transformation, but it can't be in this form right now. Like, that's not really gonna work out, at least for the purposes of theorizing what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, but
the difficult thing about this, is that the point is not that like Marxism is refuted or whatever. The point is simply that like you end up having to make a lot more decisions out, like in order to make these kinds of general Marxist claims that I have to lay out like more concrete, you just end up having to bring in, for want of a better word, extra material, either other theorists, other philosophers, or some specific struggle you're involved in outside of the, you know, and that eventually forces you to have to take stands on questions that like the original material just doesn't give you, you know. So it's, the issue with post-Marxism, I think, is like not that like, oh, there is this original Marxist program, you know, which they get wrong. It's that there just is the object they're reacting to is really diffuse. So labeling them as like, you know, Marxism is a very open-ended project, which can, the central theses are like general enough and the concepts are general enough that like the central insights can be developed in like a number of different ways, clearly. Otherwise, just, you know, the 100 years of theoretical history wouldn't have happened, you know. And in some sense, like the project of trying to give a systematic foundation to Marxism, in Lukács' sense, always has to be seen as, I think, like a practical and political project. Right. There is no objective way of making Marx's insights like completely systematic and like answering.
Yeah.
You have to decide, maybe not in this like existentialist way, decide freely, but like you have to decide like what you have to come to Marxism in some sense, some pre-existing understanding of like what good politics is, what the goals of theory are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, and that understanding will always have to be, I think, to some extent, external to the Holy Writ, and probably has to be like from your context, right? So it's more just like, what's refuted is not so much some specific doctrinal claims of Marxism and so on and so forth, right? What's refuted is the idea that like, the central concepts of Marxism can be spelled out, as it were, objectively to give you a whole system that solves all your problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kind of, I think a way of putting this is like this Rob Lucas thing you talked about, right? Which is like, you know, how to be a Marxist when capitalism is only one thing on the horizon. Mm-hmm. or where the tool of value critique only seems to have like local applicability, or the more you try to spell it out, the more you have to integrate non-value theoretic. Right? And that's the difficulty. I mean, in a sense, it really doesn't matter if you like, because it's like a practical project, it really doesn't matter whether, you know, you label the good project discovering real Marxism or not. And, you know, because you can just be, because the whole point is the vessel can contain many things, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, so the difficult, yeah. So we have to, I think, begin asking ourselves these questions of like, yeah, where does politics begin? Where does theorizing begin? In a way that answers to the circumstances of our own situation, and in which Marxism will be an important constituent part, but okay, probably not the foundation.
That's it for this episode. Thank you for joining in to this bonus interview on the Radical Thoughts podcast. Our next episode will be the final book of season 2, Late Marxism, by Frederick Jameson. Grab a copy if you want to read the text before the episode comes out. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.